Our reading this morning is taken from the book of Luke, chapter 9, from verse 18 to 22, 43 to 45, and 51. So, verse 18. Once when Jesus was praying in private and his disciples were with him, he asked them, "Who do the crowds say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, that one of the prophets of long ago has come back to life." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "God's Messiah." Jesus strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone. And he said, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. And he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." Verse 43. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men." But they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them so that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. And finally, verse 51. As the time approached for him to be taken up to Jerusalem, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. I'll do that again. As the time approached for him to be taken to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good morning, everyone. I took a bit of a flyer about 10 days ago and managed to hurt my spine and damage some ribs. And so I'm preaching today on codeine, and my wife is hoping it's an improvement over my normal preaching. That's what she said this morning. Oxford's own J.R.R. Tolkien loved the motif of the unexpected, and he regularly employed it in his writings. He wrote about unexpected parties, treasure in unexpected places, gold found in unexpected places, courage found in unexpected places, unexpected adventures, unexpected feasts, doing and saying things altogether unexpected. And when he was commenting on Lord of the Rings once, he said, "The story grew and put down roots in unexpected places." And to many, certainly at the time of Christ, who were tracking with the ministry of Jesus, his story appeared to go in unexpected direction. But Jesus was not taken by surprise, and he knew fully well the story that had been written for him. His ministry had been a huge success in Galilee, there in the villages set between the rolling green hills and the sparkling lake of Galilee. Crowds came to see this phenomenon from Nazareth, to bathe in his teachings and to thrill at his miracles. And there was mounting excitement and expectation of where all of this was going to lead. It was like a political campaign that was gaining momentum, and people were giddy at the prospect of their man in the seat of power, overthrowing the enemies and fulfilling their hopes and bringing prosperity to them all. And they'd loved Jesus the teacher, and they'd loved Jesus the healer, and they'd loved Jesus, the one who fed them. They'd loved Jesus, who sided with the poor. They'd loved Jesus, who sided and promoted women. But now, what they wanted, what they were excited about, was Jesus the Messiah, Jesus the King, Jesus the ruler on the throne in Jerusalem. And their rabbi had won them, as it were, in the primaries. And now their sight was set on the presidency. And of course, for those who'd followed him faithfully, his disciples, they thought they were going to share in this power, in this prestige, in this honor. And they couldn't wait to get up to Jerusalem because they thought that once Jesus took the throne and took the authority, then they would sit at his left and his right. And they even talked among themselves, which of us is going to be the greatest. But then suddenly the tone changes in the story. And verse 51, that was read to us twice, says, when the days drew near for him to be received up to heaven, Jesus set his face to go to Jerusalem. There is evidence, going back to 1992, that whoever has the whitest teeth as the candidate for US presidency will get the job. But Jesus set his face. He wasn't grinning with white teeth. There may even have been a grimace. He was gritting his teeth because he knew what awaited him. And in the next few weeks, we will journey with him to that place, into the heart of darkness. So that's the first thing I want us to consider this morning, is Jesus setting his face for Jerusalem and a journey into the heart of darkness. So he fixes his face, and he's steely and resolute and determined, and he's got his game face on. Why? Why was he not excited like the crowds? Why was he not looking forward to this like the disciples? Because unlike them, he knew exactly what was waiting for him when he got there. Jerusalem in Hebrew means the city of peace. But he knew that this was going to be anything but peaceful for him. And he knew that he would have to, as it were, endure the end of peace in his life, the peace that he experienced with God, in order to establish in that city the peace for others with God. Jerusalem was to be no campaign party, no crowning glory, no pilgrimage, but sinister shadows awaited him there. There were wicked schemes of wicked men being wickedly worked. And the fickle crowds were there. He knew this was coming. And first they would accept him and celebrate his coming, and then they would jeer and shout and reject and call for his crucifixion. His closest friends would abandon him and deny him. One of his closest friends who shared his cup would betray him. He would face accusation and inquisition and defamation of character and lies, and then a cowardly and unjust sentencing and fierce beatings and mocking and derision and scorn and nakedness and shame. And there he would be hung on a cross, and there he would take the sins of the world upon his shoulder, and there he would go into the very heart of darkness. And worst of all, that eternal love relationship with his Father would be severed as he who knew no sin became sin for us. So that is why Jesus fixes his face for Jerusalem. That is why there is a kind of cold breeze that blows across the text as we read this, and a shiver can go through our spine if we're attentive to it. Jesus fixes his face like flint before the fear that would steal his breath away because of destiny that awaited him and dread death that awaited. And this is a thin red line that runs throughout the life of Jesus, this scarlet thread. At his conception, the angel said, you will give him the name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. How? How's he going to do that? The name Jesus means Yahweh saves. How is he going to save? He's going to save his people from their sins by not saving himself. At his birth, the wise men journeyed from afar and gave gifts, gold, and that's a gift for a king, frankincense, gift for a priest, myrrh, that's a strange gift. That's perfume that's used to embalm the dead. That's like giving a coffin to a child as a christening present. But Jesus is born to die. He entered this world in order to die for us. At his circumcision, the aged priest Simeon celebrated and says, "My eyes have seen the salvation which you have prepared," as he held the child Jesus on the eighth day. Here, somehow encapsulated through this infant, who he is and what he does, salvation will come, rescue, deliverance, wholeness, reconciliation with God through this little baby. How? Then he turns to Mary, says, "A sword will pierce your heart also." He saw salvation, incarnate salvation, and he saw how that would happen. And it would break Mary's heart, and so it did, as she stood and watched her son breathe his last at the cross. At his baptism, John the Baptist would say, "Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." How? How does a lamb take away sin? By taking sin on itself and dying as a substitute and a sacrifice. And in the context of our reading, we've had Peter's declaration. I encourage you to go back and look at the text. Jesus asks the question, "Who do people say that I am?" This is a fundamental question that he addresses to all of us. Who do people say that I am? And then who do you say that I am? And the disciples say, "Oh, some say John the Baptist, some say the prophet." He says, "Yeah, but who do you say that I am?" And Jesus said, "You are the Messiah, God's anointed king, the one that the Spirit has sent to rule in Israel." And Jesus says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of John. This was not revealed to you by my men, but by my Father in heaven," and da-da-da-da-da. And then immediately in verse 22, he says, "Listen, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and teachers of the law and must be killed and on the third day rise again." This is a Christological high point, a peak moment of divine disclosure and a revelation of who Jesus is, the anointed king. And Jesus then has to flip their understanding of what that will mean and immediately says, "We're going to Jerusalem. I'm going to be rejected. I'm going to be killed. And then I'm coming back." And then in the next scene, there's the transfiguration. Jesus is on the mountain. And there, Elijah and Moses come. The law and the prophets come to affirm Jesus. And then a voice from the cloud speaks, "This is my son." God the Father's affirmation of Jesus. And then as they go down the hill, there's a demonized boy. And the disciples can't sort him out and help him. And Jesus, with a word, can set him free. And they're in awe at this revelation. It says that they're amazed at this demonstration of power. And of course, the inner group of disciples are amazed because they've seen something of who Jesus is. And immediately, at this Christological peak, Jesus says, "Listen carefully. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." They didn't understand what he meant. It was hidden from them. And as he taught in the temple and in those last few days leading up to his betrayal and execution, repeatedly he returned to this theme: the Son of Man does not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom, buying back many. Except a grain of wheat fall into the ground and die. I am the good shepherd who lays down my life for the sheep. And on and on and on. And this is that ever warm scarlet thread that runs through the life of Jesus. And often we want to be associated with Jesus' ministry or his wise words or his preferential bias to the poor or his affirmation of women or his beauty and wonder or whatever it is. And all of those things are absolutely right and true and proper because they are who he is. But he is also the one who must fix his face for Jerusalem because he goes there to die for the sins of the world. At the Last Supper, and we're going to come to communion in a moment, celebrating the deliverance of Israel from Egypt, Jesus takes the bread and wine. This is my body broken for you. This is my blood shed for you. This is a commentary on what will unfold at Calvary. And this is the heartbeat of our faith. T.S. Eliot wrote, "Destiny waits in the hands of God, not in the hands of statesmen." And this is the journey to the cross. It is the destiny. It is the story that has been written by God, written for Jesus, and written to include you and me. And then secondly, Jesus fixes his gaze on Jerusalem because his heart is fixed on you. Why does he do it? Because love compels him. And when he fixes his face to Jerusalem with all that determination, he's carrying you in his heart. He's got you in his mind. And the anxiety of Calvary that would cause dread adrenaline to course through his body, nevertheless, we're told in Hebrews, for the joy set before him. And so there are two things going on. There's dread and there's joy. The dread because he knows the cost. The joy because he knows what it'll buy. And he's thinking of us. And this is the extraordinary thing about Easter. We're written into this story. You and me. You and me are part of the story. And you're on his mind and you're in his hand and you're in his heart and you're written on his hands when he's hung on that tree. Last Easter, Matthew Paris, who I do like his writing, but I don't often agree with him, he said in the Times, he criticized the church. He said, for its obsession with Jesus as victim. And he says, the church is always playing the victim card. But Jesus never claims victim status. And Jesus is not a hapless victim of situation and circumstance. That's why he says, no one takes my life from me. I'm laying it down freely. Jesus is Lord and he's in charge over the whole story. He's the writer of this story. And this is the God who loves us in freedom and who lays down his life to love us back to life. And it is a complete mystery. And I still don't understand it. And every Easter we come to it afresh. And I try to see it again and understand again. Why on earth, how on earth could that happen? And it's a mystery. And it's a marvel. It's a wonder that God who creates the universe would become flesh and die upon a cross in order to bring all flesh to himself. I loved Stephen's sermon 2 weeks ago when he talked about God being good at judo. Jesus does judo. He's a judo master. And there is a sense that the demonic involved in this drama is hoisted by its own petard. At the cross, God uses the full force of the enemy against himself, the demonic. And in that movement and moment, Christ's death satisfies God's justice and it annuls our sin and it puts death to death and it opens up life and it reconciles us to God. The judo of the cross, what a brilliant thing. Many of you know Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and C.S. Lewis portrays Jesus as Aslan, the lion, who chooses willingly to die in the place of Edmund. And the White Witch thinks she's won. They've tied him down and she's slain her nemesis, her adversary. But then Aslan comes to life. And all that has been wrought and worked by the wicked white witch and turned to ice is undone. And life returns. And Aslan explains it like this. He says, there is a magic deeper still, which she did not know. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. And she would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. The deeper magic. We see this thin red line through the life of Jesus. And behind that, there is a deeper magic. The wicked witch, she didn't expect a sequel. She didn't expect Aslan to come back. Unexpected story. The Pharisees didn't expect Jesus to come back. The Romans didn't expect Jesus to come back. The disciples didn't expect Jesus to come back. The crowds didn't expect Jesus to come back. The forces of evil didn't expect Jesus to come back. But Jesus expected to come back, and he had told them so. And on the third day, I will rise. Finally, the challenge, the question for us as we get on this journey for Jerusalem at Easter is, where is our heart and our face set? The Gospels show us, with very few exceptions, perhaps the women and John the Beloved and maybe Joseph of Arimathea, but hardly anyone else, that people actually were fixed on themselves. The Romans and the Jewish leaders and the crowds were fixed with self-interest. And Judas was fixed on making money. And Peter and some of the disciples were fixed initially on self-glory and then on self-preservation and saving their skin. Where is our heart fixed this Easter? I was challenged again last week. I was unable to get to church, and I was listening to the sermon, Stephen preaching on Gift Sunday. If you didn't hear that, I do encourage you to listen on our YouTube channel. And Stephen said last week, he said, follow the money and you'll get to the heart. Follow the money and you'll get to the heart. And it shook me. And you know, I've got a confession to make. My heart is often not given to God. I mean, I'm a professional Christian. I'm actually an ordained priest for 30 years, but often my heart's elsewhere. Often my heart is on me and my own self-interests and my own peculiarities and idiosyncrasies. And sure, I religiously give my tithes and my offering, but generally I've given out of duty and obedience and not out of worship. And often my giving has been more like the act of an accountant doing the books than it has of a lover lavishing on the beloved. I listened to Stephen's sermon with Tiffany. I'd already decided what I thought we should give, and a sum enough to make me feel virtuous, but not enough to hurt. And Tiffany always gives more than I want to give, and so I upped it, hoping that she wouldn't try and up it again, and she said, okay. But then I heard Stephen's sermon, and I thought, oh, no. And but I was moved. The heart. Follow the money, you get to the heart. And so I then gave more than I expected. And Tiffany was so excited by that. Having sent the money there and then, she said, shall we up our giving? I said, no. I can't cope with that at the moment. Let me recover first. You see, Jesus fixes his face to Jerusalem because he'd fixed his heart on Jerusalem, because he'd given his heart to us. And how do we respond at Easter? Well, we are to receive him if we haven't before, or if we've let him go. We receive him back in our life as our Lord and Savior. But we're also to fix our heart on him.